Hi, everyone. Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Tom Coffeen, and I'm here with my co-host, Scott Hoag. Today, we've got a special guest with us. We're going to talk about measuring your IPv6 transition. We're joined by Chip Popovich with NEFO6, and he's here to talk about his work around IPv6 measurements and tools he and his company have developed to help figure this all out. Hi, Chip. Welcome to IPv6 Buzz. And why don't you get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself, your background, and why IPv6 is of interest to you?
Thanks, Tom and Scott, for inviting me. So a little bit about my background. I jumped into IPv6 way back when I was at Cisco. This was almost 17 years ago or more. And basically what happened was I was just coming off of a large voice over IP project that I was working on for very large customers. And I was offered an option to choose a technology that I would like to work on. And so actually I was debating between IPv6 and mobile IP. Knowing the fate of mobile IP, I think IPv6 was a good choice, but then knowing the history of IPv6, that still remains to be debated. So I started working on IPv6 very early on. And this was a fantastic opportunity because if you're very early on a technology, you get a chance to really work with very bright people, very smart people. But I had a chance to work with very, very good developers, amazing folks at Cisco. I work on very on leading projects. And it just so happened that by the time I got a little bit of knowledge under my belt, we just had this major opportunity to work on the next generation infrastructure for a very large service provider. And so things kind of fell into place, and I had a chance to build and to work on one of the largest IPv6 deployments in the world at the time. I'm not sure if it still is, to be honest with you, which is a good thing. And since then, I had an opportunity to work on all kind of IPv6 environments and all aspects of IPv6 transition, everything from working on products and working on solutions to actually working on assessing environments for IPv6, developing strategies, doing planning, and then execution. And so along the way, I worked with several folks on two Cisco Press books, Deploying IPv6 Networks, is a very big doorstopper. and then because as an engineer, I was all excited about it. I was all, gung-ho about, writing the reference for IPv6 at a time, for deploying IPv6 at a time. And I was thinking with this, the floodgates will open and IPv6 will be everywhere. Obviously, it turned out not to be the case. So I thought maybe the business case is missing and maybe I should go after the business case. So we followed up with another book under Cisco Press called, it was much more of a book for business folks, if you would. It was a collection of case studies and a collection of business cases for IPv6. Well, there are a bunch of years since that came out.
And that's sorry to interrupt, that's Global IPv6 Strategies, is that right?
Global IPv6 Strategies,
yes.
That's right. And still the floodgates did not open, as you guys know. And I've been working with a lot of customers, and along the way, I've been trying to figure out a lot what are the challenges that we need to overcome in order to finally get this technology adopted in droves. So, long history, have the bruises to prove that I was there.
That's right. Well, I got to tell you, since I've got you on our podcast here, I have to admit, I have a confession. And the Global IPv6 Strategies book, I don't want you to feel like you're shouting into the wind there. You may have heard this comment from other folks, but when I first got started with IPv6 a little bit later, significantly later in 2008, 2009 timeframe, I'd been tasked with deploying it at Limelight, as I think you're probably aware. But that was actually one of the first books that I picked up, and it was actually available for free, I think, at one of the conferences I went to. It got handed out. Maybe it was at the Google conference in 2008 or 2009. In any case, I read it from cover to cover. And I have to say that, you know, even though it's not really a book that's focused on sort of the technical nitty-gritty of deploying IPv6, it was really transformational for me when I read it. It really sort of opened my eyes to the bigger picture around IPv6. And it actually is one of the data points that sort of inspired me to head in the direction of you know, trying to drag enterprises to IPv6, for better or worse, as you've acknowledged that particular struggle. But yeah, lots of great information in that book, and you know, I would encourage readers that have an IPv6 interest, anybody that's listening to the podcast, that, you know, it sounds like on the surface, well, you know, if it's business cases, maybe I'm not as interested in it as how, say, neighbor discovery works. But there's a lot of great information in that book, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I agree. I'd highly recommend it too, because I think many organizations, the network engineers, the IT folks, they may be interested in the technology, but they're like, how do I make this a project? Well, you have to have executive sponsorship support to give you the time to work on moving IPv6 forward in your organization. And this book, Global IPv6 Strategies, would give you those talking points to be able to map features or functions, capabilities that IPv6 gives you to your organization's mission, you know, business strategy, to kind of sell it upstream and garner that executive support.
Yes, I agree. And of course, for the audience, for folks who are listening on this podcast, I think you guys, you know, are touching on all these points along the way as you're building this library of content. And I really think that the audience stands to learn a lot from all these experiences that we all had on trying to get these things in, trying to fit it in an organization's plan and strategy, trying to make it palatable to the both leadership and technology folks who are trying to bridge, you know, the perspectives that come between these two or these various sides of the organization. As we all say, IPv6 really literally touches every aspect of IT to be better.
Well, that's a good point to segue to talk a little bit about, if you don't mind, to talk a little bit about what your product does. Our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with it would be interested to hear how it works.
Yes. So basically, we started as networking folks. And I was a networking guy for a very long time, and then I started to move up the stack. And one of the things that bothered me was this idea that management tools are very complicated. You need a bunch of them. They're all over the place, and they're afterthoughts. And for better or for worse, these tools are very, very siloed. So the networking guys have their own tools, the data center guys have their own tools, business guys have their own tools, and so on. And the problem with that is that you can very clearly see in IT organizations how these groups are, it's like Babel's Tower, right? It's people just start to talk their own language, and they are completely dissociated. One group sees a problem, blames it on the other group, but they don't have the right type of data to sort of bridge their perspectives. Moreover, the complexity in our environments requires more and more complex, or seems to require more and more complex tools. And so our idea was to try to fix this problem in a very, very simple way, without a lot of investment, without a lot of effort. Just one, two statistics that I want to mention that in this context. An EMA study showed that 42% of the issues that are reported by users, so somebody was mad, had a problem, was mad, picked up the phone and called in an issue, 42% of those issues go completely unnoticed by the networking team. And this happens when 56% of organizations use 12 or more management tools just for the network. So that is an investment that is definitely not paying off if I miss so many issues. And remember, just picking up the phone is $15 on average for an organization. So definitely a lot of inefficiency. And once these issues are detected, people or the networking team spend about 33% of their time troubleshooting these issues. So our view was, let's find a way by which we can bridge the user's perspective with the way the networking folks look at issues. And our approach was to simulate users. So we created this agent. They are very light. We can deploy them on anything, anything from wearable technology like Edison, the Edison platform from Intel, to Raspberry Pis of the various kinds or any type of ARM platform, to containers, to virtual machines, whatever you have a little bit of compute power. We can put it obviously even on networking devices. And these agents are all managed to a cloud controller. And these agents, they behave like a user. The nice thing about that is that these agents, when they create synthetic transactions in checking applications and services, they actually walk the entire stack as a user would. And so they check everything from DNS all the way to the application. And we collect all that data and we baseline everything. So we have a baseline for DNS, we have baselines for the network path, there are baselines for the applications, connect times, and so on and so forth. Now, what's interesting about this is that this type of instrumentation allows you to, on one hand, learn about your environment from the user's perspective. Two, it allows you to detect issues proactively before users do. And then it allows you to have the data that a lot of time network engineers have to scramble to get to show the application teams, to show the security teams that is not a network problem. As we all know, when there is an issue, everybody blames the network. This type of data enables them to kind of have that conversation about the issues that are being observed. And we do all these measurements over IPv4 and IPv6. So we collect the data, we baseline it, and then we go into a monitoring mode automatically, where we automatically detect issues based on historical information. So we have an analytics engine that does that. Just as a side note, we have universities that have and still use the platform for V6 research, for example. And they did find, or they did measure those very much talked about performance optimizations or improvements with IPv6 or IPv4 for certain applications in the cloud. They detected problems in environments that were dual stack, where V6 was enabled and that whole autonomous system automatically was pushed on the Google blacklist. Our tool was able to discover all those problems. So it is a tool that is IP version agnostic. It does V4 and V6. Is very much focused on helping the networking folks deliver or do their job easier and gain the service perspective. But it's a very good tool that can be used in the V6 transition, where it first it's used to automatically baseline the V4 environment and then to track the V6.
Yeah, because I mean, the reality is, and the irony of it is that enterprises have many IPv6 capable and enabled by default devices in their environment. Their employees use these devices when they're in the office, but presumably maybe it's an IPv4 only enterprise, you know, backbone network, but they take those devices home. But then the mobile devices that the employees have in their pockets, in their backpacks, operate IPv6 maybe over a mobile provider's network, or they could have IPv6 when they're home or on the road or working remotely. And the help desk teams maybe lack experience with IPv6 to be able to troubleshoot when IPv6 is a factor. But there could be, it's that 42% you were talking about that go unresolved or unnoticed. They don't know that these IPv6 issues could be cropping up, or there could be connections taking place over IPv6. I mean, you know, high degree of possibility that if a sales executive is relying upon LinkedIn and they're using a mobile device that uses IPv6 and they're using LinkedIn, presumably over IPv6, that And there's problems there that affect the sales productivity of that individual. And that person has a problem and they log a trouble ticket. The help desk doesn't even know that that connection may be taking V6 transport. But your monitoring system, and our listeners may be thinking, oh, I don't need an IPv6 monitoring system because I didn't deploy an IPv6 network. Well, you kind of did. You have these connections and you want to understand end user experience over both protocols. And you want to arm the help desk teams with tools that just test both protocols by default right out of the gate.
I totally agree with that. And there are several things that I wanted to also add to it, to the point that you're making. So first off, this would not be just a dedicated V6 tool. It would be a tool that would allow the networking guys to get a perspective on the services that they are delivering, but a perspective from that encompasses everything. It's the user perspective. And that it's extremely powerful in making sure that I'm not just sitting within my networking silo. I'm having the bigger picture. I'm having the complete view and understand exactly what users see over my network. Second thing is, you are absolutely right, and I have a very good example. We work with a university, a very large university. They had at the time an architect, network architect, who was extremely passionate, very, very knowledgeable, but very passionate about the work that he was doing. And he decided to move the entire infrastructure to IPv6 on his own time. And, you know, he read our books, all of our books combined, and he said, well, no big deal. I can do it. He did it, turned it on, and they showed up on Google's blacklist. And they could not figure out what the problem is. Of course, Google is not going to get into this type of competitive discussion. The vendors that he was working with, technology vendors that he was working with, could not help. And actually, at the time, one of the Google SMEs recommended to him to use our tool. So we put it in. We immediately gave them a perspective on what was going on. We fixed the issue. It was a routing asymmetry that was really peaking when certain traffic patterns were happening. Solved that. Got off the blacklist, and in along the way, he started to solve some V4 problems. But what happened was, you know, I had a very good relationship with him. We were just, you know, engineers, all excited about it. He then moved on. He actually works for a big vendor right now. The new guys who came in were very busy. They didn't want to deal with this anymore. So they're like, we don't need this monitoring right now. It's okay. We're going to take a break. Just happened to meet the new architect at a Cisco Live conference and just checking in with him to see how things are going. He's like, oh man, I wish I had that in there, because we spent so much time with so many people screaming at us that Google, the Gmail was not working. And we were just could not understand what the problem was. And we were looking and looking and looking. Well, guess what turned out to be the problem? It turned out that the service, the two links, the two internet connections that they had, two different service providers, they get all their Gmail over IPv6. They get their Gmail over IPv6 over the main link. And then that link went down, and the other link, the backup, was not enabled for IPv6. And all these users were trying to use IPv6 for their connectivity. And they had such a hard time trying to figure out what the issue really was. So once you get into this dual stack environment, yes, somebody will call in with a problem. You will not know exactly what transport is he or she using. And depending on how much access you're going to have to their machine, you may or may not be able to troubleshoot that very fast.
Mm-hmm. And the nature of enterprise networks are changing to improve end-user experience. Software-defined WAN. You know, we're bringing direct internet access into branches where a large volume of productivity is produced for an enterprise. And we want to give those folks who are producing a lot of revenue for the business the best end-user experience to reach their cloud applications. And, you know, people go home and they have high-speed broadband. And if you're an enterprise and you want to attract new millennials to come work for you, and you put an Albatross laptop around their neck that has a Core i3 processor, super slow network, and make them use Lotus Notes, you know, they're not going to last.
Exactly. It's amazing how impactful user experience is. I was talking with somebody who did a survey of teachers in schools in North Carolina. And teachers in schools in North Carolina are not really that well paid compared with other states in the U.S., unfortunately. But what that survey said was that the teachers are more likely to walk out because of poor IT performance and IT services than because of the salary. So this is a very serious problem that people might not sort of appreciate it enough. And then in the context that you're mentioning, where now we're moving towards an internet-centric backbone, and we move towards, you know, based around SD-WAN, and we move towards all these sort of aggregation of service delivery, where not all the resources for my services are on campus anymore, they are in the cloud somewhere, where all these organizations have to come together on a good faith basis, in many cases, to deliver these mission critical services, right? It's your home network, it's your access provider, internet access provider, several backbone providers, probably a cloud provider and an application provider. All these guys have to come together to deliver the application to your end user. That end user has no clue about all these other people. He just knows that you are the one who's responsible for his productivity. So if he has an issue, you need to know that issue as soon as possible, and you have to know right away who owns that problem. Because if it's not your network, you should not waste time trying to figure out what the problem is and how can I deal with it. What you should do is you should have the data available in order to contact the right owner, cloud provider, application provider, the internet access provider, and tell them, there is a problem. This is where we think the problem is. It's outside of our hands. You guys need to deal with it. It's your responsibility. Let's cut the finger pointing and jump straight into solving this issue. And sometimes, if you're just going to go with your, trace routes, and you're just going to go with your, interface counters and so on and so forth, that conversation can be very, very long. And that means downtime, that means productivity loss.
Yeah, Chip, I think you've really outlined the case for better measurement. For the purposes of our IPv6 discussion, I mean, where do you see things going from here? It's clear, based at least to me, based on what you've argued to this point, that measurement is certainly necessary, but I don't know if it's sufficient. And what do you see as the next best steps forward for improving IPv6 adoption rates in the enterprise? Because that obviously that's where the laggards are showing up in terms of the lack of IPv6 adoption. What do you think?
Well, so for many, many years, my number one metric of success was that adoption. And over the past 3 years or so, I've kind of changed that because of the whole metrics discussions, the discussion where my number one metric is just enable it well. And enable it whenever you want and however you want. Take your time if you want to, but enable it well so we don't miss this opportunity. But no doubt about it that I am still a very big supporter of let's get it done and let's enable IPv6. I believe that this is going to continue to be a difficult conversation. I mean, I've been working on this for a long time. I've talked with a lot of people, and it still is not an easy conversation. But what I believe is very clear is that people understand that they have a problem to deal with. They just don't know when to pull the trigger. And so the easier we make this conversation for them, the better. The more we can talk to them about, you know, this whole discussion of driving readiness through refresh cycles and you know, just turn it on as you move along. It's not that hard. Start to build IPv6 and IPv6 requirements into your processes so that your services teams, your application teams, your operation teams are slowly getting ready for IPv6. I think that kind of gets them a little bit less concerned about budgeting and so on, and gets them a little bit more comfortable with just driving the migration or the transition or the enablement with through a little bit of support from the leadership. That said, I honestly think that the big switch, if you would, is going to come with IoT. And I have a lot of faith in IoT. We all know that there is a lot of IoT that also was built based on IPv6, communication level at least. And the reason I have a lot of faith in that as being a push for adoption is because ultimately you can build that in an isolated space, so an isolated domain, layer 3 domain or layer 2 domain. You can also, these are also technologies that kind of come as overlays that come on top of existing environments, so it's going to be a little bit easier to plug them in. But they are driven by very specific business decision. And so what I would like to see, I would like to see us as a community, customers, providers, and so on and so forth, make a concerted effort on driving V6, making V6 sort of the only way IoT devices that use IP, the only way IoT devices communicate. If we do that, I believe that we're going to have more and more of these V6 showing up in the environments and then inevitably dragging the rest of the organization along into a IPv6 only.
Yeah, great points. Well, I think we're running out of time. Unlike IPv6, we have a limited amount of space for our podcast, but I really want to thank you for joining us today, Chip. You've made some really thoughtful points, and I'm hoping our audience will have an opportunity to follow up and investigate what your product does, see some of the value inherent in doing some of those measurements that we talked about, how critical that is to the path of IPv6 adoption. If the folks that are listening want to follow you on the internet, how would they do that?
Basically, I have my Twitter account, which is Zamoxis V6. And I'm always available via email, chip@nephosix.com. Always happy to answer questions.
Very good. And then also, we can check out the product at nephosix.com?
Right.
Okay, very good. And then Scott, how do folks follow you on the internet?
At Scott Hoag is my Twitter handle, and just Google Scott Hoag, IPv6. That's all they can find me.
Tons of results, right? And I'm at IPv6 Tom. So check out the three of us online for more information about IPv6 and how you can get started if you haven't started already, and what the next best steps are if you have. Thanks so much for listening to IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers Community Podcast at packetpushers.net/series/community-podcast. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.